My guest today is Jules Boykoff, professor of political science at Pacific University and the author of numerous books on social movements and the politics of sports and the Olympics, including his most recent book, What Are the Olympics For? Professor Boykoff is also a poet who's co-authored a book about the politics of poetry in public space with his spouse, Street Roots executive director, Kaya Sand. He's a former professional soccer player who frequently co-authors articles and commentaries with Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation, and the two will soon be in Paris covering the Olympics. Thanks so much for speaking with me today, Jules.
My pleasure.
Okay, and before we get going, I just want to note for listeners that you'll be reading from your new book, What Are the Olympics For?, this coming Thursday, July 18th at 7 p.m. at Powell's Books. So in What Are the Olympics For?, you offer a pretty scathing critique of the Olympics, and you make it really clear that concerns about doping in the Olympics have substantially eclipsed public discussion of a host of other critical issues, including, you know, staggering budget overruns, quote, displacement of local people, the militarization of public space, greenwashing, corruption, unquote, and basically on and on. Mm-hmm. I mean, you offer an overview of the origins of the modern Olympic Games beginning in 1894 in Paris with Baron Pierre de Coubertin, who convened, as you recount, a meeting of carefully selected allies, including King Leopold of Belgium, to move forward his vision for the modern Olympics, which would premiere in Athens in 1896. So can you talk a little bit about Coubertin and the elite interests that shaped and continue to shape the games, and about some of the protocols established by the International Olympic Committee, or the IOC, and the ways that these protocols have variously excluded, exploited, displaced, silenced, surveilled, and criminalized working class and BIPOC communities?
Absolutely. So the history of the Olympics is built on a firm foundation of racism, classism, and sexism. And it has a lot to do with the guy that you mentioned, that plucky French baron who restarted the modern Olympics in the 1890s. He himself was extremely sexist. He said at the beginning of those Olympics that women had no role in the games, that if they wanted to participate in the Olympics, they could place the laurels on the heads of the victorious champion men, or he said they could produce baby boys that could grow up to become Olympians. He was also a racist. He would say things about Africa whole cloth, saying they have 1,000 jealousies of the white man. That was a quote. And he would say, therefore, they should be allowed to participate in the Olympics. So it was kind of an awkward and odd construction. But he was racist to the core, anti-Asian, you name it. This guy said it. And third, he was classist. I mean, he was an aristocrat himself. As you noted, Desiree, when he set up the International Olympic Committee in the 1890s, he invited a bunch of his friends that were also dukes and princes and barons and kings, and they started the International Olympic Committee for themselves. I mean, if you were a mechanic or a bricklayer or a grape picker, you would not be included in the Olympics because you would be considered professional in the early days of the games. Well, of course, that left the field wide open for people like the Baron and his ilk to scoop up all these rewards. These men of leisure really benefited from those specific rules. And so you might think that that is just ancient history, but in reality, those decisions by Baron Pierre de Coubertin way back when actually continue to inflect the games today, where you have struggles over sexism, racism, and classism.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the ways that athletes and communities have pushed back?
Absolutely. So from the beginning of the Olympics, there were athletes who stood up against the injustices that are bricked into the sports mega event. There have also been communities that have said, you know, do we really want to spend our time and money on an optional sporting festival for like 17 days instead of the real deal issues that face our community? And so one of my favorite examples that a lot of people might not have heard about is from the 1906 Olympics in Athens, where there was this amazing athlete from Ireland named Peter O'Connor. And Peter O'Connor was an Irish nationalist and an ardent one at that. And yet, because Ireland was being ruled by Westminster at the time, he was forced to compete for Great Britain in those 1906 Olympics, and he was not at all happy about it. So when he won a medal and it was time to hoist the flag up the flagpole and get your prize, they hoisted up the Union Jack up the flagpole, and he ran over to that flagpole. He shimmied up it and he pulled down the Union Jack and held up instead this Erin Go Bragh Ireland Forever flag over his head, while his two buddies, also Irish guys that were forced to compete for Great Britain, stood at the bottom of the flagpole to fend off the Greek police. Just an incredible moment. So from the beginning, athletes have been standing up. Same for communities. I mean, an example from the early days of the Olympics, 1932 Olympics in Los Angeles, happening during the Depression. You had protests in Sacramento, California, that had signs like groceries, not games. Fast forwarding to the 21st century, every single Olympic city, for reasons that we can get into, find themselves having protests against them, both in the lead up to and then also during the Olympics. And, you know, that athlete activist streak that I mentioned, maybe starting with Peter O'Connor, has gotten only more lively in our contemporary era. I think it's fair to say we're living in what we might call the athlete empowerment era. And so at the last Summer Olympics in Tokyo in 2021, postponed by a year because of coronavirus, you saw the U.S. shot putter, Raven Saunders, put her hands above her head to express support and solidarity with oppressed people everywhere. A clear breach of the International Olympic Committee's Olympic Charter, which says that athletes actually can't engage in protest inside of any Olympic zones, but she did it anyways and showed a lot of courage. So the history of the Olympics runs thick with pushback, both from activists and also from communities that are hosting the Games.
Yeah, and I think most people are most familiar with is it the 68 Olympics in which Juan Carlos and Tommy Smith really took a public stand?
Absolutely. 1968 Olympics was an epic moment of athlete activism. So on the medal stand after the 200 meter dash, John Carlos and Tommy Smith put their fists in the air in solidarity with people around the world for human rights, for Black rights, for freedom, in support of the struggle. And they were part of a larger group. And I think it's important to note that this wasn't some wild card thing that just kind of happened in the spur of the moment. They were part of an activist movement, athlete activist movement called the Olympic Project for Human Rights. And they paid a real price for their courageous activism. They were kicked out of the Olympic Village. And the person who got also who placed and was on the medal stand with them, a white sprinter from Australia named Peter Norman, he also was punished because he wore a little button on his shirt that said OPHR, Olympic Project for Human Rights, this group that these athletes were involved with. And he too faced real consequences when he returned to Australia. And so that in that epic moment, I think we learn a lot. One, that athletes are willing to stand up against the overlords of the Olympics. And two, that typically when we see athlete activism, it's because there are these vibrant political movements happening around them of which they are a part.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the other organizations that have specifically taken on the Olympics and taken on the ways in which it saddles communities with debt, it promises to develop affordable housing and then instead creates housing for the wealthy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, I think it might help to just sort of lay out exactly what you're doing there is what are the problems with the Olympics in the modern era? And one of them is costs. I mean, Olympic costs just go through the roof each and every time. And this puts taxpayers on the hook to cover the event. So basically, it becomes this sort of massive transfer of wealth upwards. You could call it trickle up economics if you want. So that's one reason that people across the political spectrum, by the way, even fiscal conservatives will stand up on that particular issue. Another big issue that plagues the Olympics is that they tend to turbocharge gentrification and displacement in the Olympic city. So when Atlanta hosted the Olympics in 1996, you had the expulsion of unhoused residents given one-way bus tickets out of town before the Olympics started. You had 9,000 tickets being issued to unhoused people in the city of Atlanta, basically putting them on the treadmill of jail and making it more difficult for them to live their lives. The idea is you get rid of those folks before the Olympics start so that when the global media arrive, they don't see any social problems in their midst. A third problem is around militarization of public space to protect the Olympic spectacle. Basically, local and national security forces in the Olympic city and host country use the Olympics like their own private cash machine to get all the special weapons and laws and funding that they would never be able to get during normal political times. And so that's why you're seeing in France this summer They're using AI-powered video surveillance to police the Olympic Games. They rammed it through the French Assembly on the idea that they needed it to police the Olympic Games. And so you can imagine people aren't that happy about that kind of racist technology in Paris. A fourth reason why people oppose the Olympics today is because of greenwashing. I mean, the Olympics talk a big green environmental game, but their follow-through is absolutely lacking. You know, I lived in Rio de Janeiro in the lead-up to the 2016 Summer Olympics there. I was a Fulbright research scholar. It was really fun. I went out to Guanabara Bay, where they were hosting some of the events. Guanabara Bay was supposed to be cleaned up to make space for the Olympic Games. 80% of the water that flowed into this bay was supposed to be filtered. By the time the Olympics rolled around, only 25 to 30%. So a clear greenwash going on there. And there are just so many examples of it left and right. And finally, the Olympics bring with them just straight up corruption. I mean, here in the United States, we know that well because we saw what happened in the Salt Lake City Winter Olympics of 2002. That was a bribery-o-rama. I mean, they were bribing International Olympic Committee members for their votes, giving IOC members, family members, knee replacements and scholarships to attend college and tickets to the Utah Jazz basketball game, fancy violins, you name it. So, because there's so much money swishing through the Olympic system, there also tends to be quite a bit of corruption. Unless you think it's some little vestige of our time in Salt Lake City, actually, currently there are four open investigations into corruption around the 2024 Paris Olympics. I doubt any of them will be resolved before the games start. But basically, corruption has become endemic inside of the Olympic Games. And because of that, you see activists that care about all those issues standing up just to say no when the Olympics come around to their city.
And it sounds like there's also kind of international organizing, pulled together cities across the world that are fighting to keep the Olympics out of their communities.
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned that because that's a fresh development that's happened in recent years. And so prior to that, what you basically had was Olympic activism was a game of whack-a-mole. The Olympics would pop up into your city and you'd try to mallet it down with your activism. Then you'd just go back to your regular activism after that once the Olympics left. Well, back in 2019, activists convened in Tokyo to try to create more of a transnational anti-Olympics network. So you had activists from Tokyo, Los Angeles, Paris, Rio, England, you name it, previous places that hosted the Olympics in South Korea and all around the world. And they came together to share strategies and tactics to try to create, instead of it being an activist moment during the Olympics, more of an activist movement that sort of traveled between Olympic Games and supported communities that were experiencing the Olympics. They had their second ever transnational anti-Olympic summit in Paris in May 2022. And I did attend both of those and found them to be really interesting and well considered from the activist point of view.
You also talk about the Workers' Olympics, which I never heard of, and which is a really interesting counterpoint to the exploitation of workers in the Olympics. Can you talk a little bit about that? What was the Workers' Olympics?
As I mentioned before, in the early days of the Olympics, workers were just sort of straight up banned from participating. They did change that pretty quick, in large part because they wanted to include famous soccer players in the Olympics, and they were clearly professional and they were going to make it work. But because of the exclusion of workers, workers said, you know what, we love sports and we're going to create our own event. And so in the 20s and 30s, there were a number of different workers' Olympics in various European cities. And they were largely supported by European socialists and communists. And they came together, and these were big events. I mean, you would get like more than 100,000 people to attend some of the ceremonies that were involved. And the other thing that was pretty cool about these was that there were moments and tears for those who are really serious about their sport. But there was also possibility for participation if you just wanted to give a sport a try or you weren't that good at it, but you just enjoyed it. And so, unlike the sort of elite sport level Olympics of today, there was multiple levels so that all could participate. And it was a raving success. I mean, they had another big Workers' Olympics planned for 1936 in Barcelona, but the rise of Francisco Franco and the fascists there kind of destroyed that dream. And one other thing I think is interesting. Astride all this with the Workers' Olympics, there was also Women's Olympics. As I mentioned before, women were treated poorly by members of the International Olympic Committee. So they organized their own Women's Olympics again in the 1920s and 1930s these were tremendously successful. I mean, the sexism that flew through Olympic circles back in that day was epic. There was this idea that if a woman rode a bicycle, they would get this strange malady called bicycle face. This was the doctors of the time saying crazy stuff like that. And so they were barred from participating in various sports because it was considered unfeminine and so on. And so they said, you know what, we're going to organize our own Olympics. And those were tremendously successful, bringing in athletes from around the world and showing that women are perfectly capable with playing sports and not getting this mysterious made-up malady called bicycle face. And so, you know, out of exclusion was born ingenuity. And this is an interesting chapter in Olympic history.
In the book, you also talk a lot about the IOC's kind of longtime sympathies with South Africa during minority rule. And I know that in a Nation commentary in January, together with Dave Zirin, you talk about the IOC's disparate responses to the Russian invasion of Ukraine and Israel's unfolding genocide in Gaza. Can you talk a little bit about those disparities and the history of boycotts?
Absolutely. So the International Olympic Committee has a rather conspicuous tolerance for tyranny, and it goes way, way back. I mean, the International Olympic Committee held the 1936 Olympics in Berlin when Adolf Hitler was in power. They knew, they could see the writing on the wall. They could see the exclusion of Roma people. They could see the exclusion of Jewish folks. And yet they still rammed ahead with their Olympics, giving an opportunity to Hitler to sports wash and look really important on the world stage. Shimmy forward to the example that you're pointing out. Obviously, you have an apartheid system in South Africa that is being racist and discriminating against Black people. And yet the International Olympic Committee desperately wanted to continue to include South Africa in the fold. It was only because of pressure put on by activists, as well as athlete activists, as well as National Olympic Committees from numerous countries that said, we're not going to participate in the Olympics if you allow racist apartheid South Africa to continue. And so in 1964, the International Olympic Committee, against its will largely, decided to exclude South Africa from the Games. And they were excluded for almost 30 years until 1992, when Mandela came back into power. It was clear that there was a transition to a more just democracy. So that's an activist victory in a lot of ways, and it shows that the International Olympic Committee can exclude countries if they're violating the Olympic Charter, as well as just like basic norms of decency and kindness. Fast forward to today, like you're saying, you've got a real complex thicket of issues around this Olympics. I would say that the Paris Olympics this summer are the most politically charged Olympics that we will see in decades, for the reasons that you gave, Desiree, one being what's happening in Russia, the invasion of Ukraine. So when that happened, the International Olympic Committee was quick to act. It banned Russia from a lot of different sports. And now you have to sort of pass through this special rubric that shows that you're not supporting the war against the Ukraine in order to participate as a neutral athlete in Paris. It looks like there's going to be around maybe a dozen or so athletes from Russia and also Belarus that will be participating in Paris. But we'll see, because there's been some wrestlers that had qualified from Russia that have decided they're actually, it's just not worth it. They're not going to go. And then the other situation, which is hanging over the head of these Olympics, which the International Olympic Committee has very much ignored, is what's going on in Gaza right now, the ongoing genocide in Gaza. And even though there have been tens of thousands of innocent Palestinians killed, the International Olympic Committee has remained silent and, in fact, has said that Israel will participate with no strictures in these summer Olympics. And so you have like the Israeli men's soccer team that qualified. And I'm going to guess that there will be protests in the streets against Israeli participation. There is a pretty robust movement online that has been fighting to try to get Israel excluded, and they're going to continue with their efforts through the Olympics. But I could go on about this, because I actually think that if you look at the way the International Olympic Committee has treated Israel, they have not been consistent in regards to how they treated Russia. The reasons that they gave to exclude Russia and to force them to participate as individual neutral athletes also apply, or at least one of them applies to Israel, and that was that Russia took over territory inside Ukraine, and then the Russian Olympic Committee used that territory to run sports clubs there. Well, hey, look at Gaza, where every single soccer stadium has been decimated, and where the Israeli Defense Forces took over the storied Yarmouk Stadium, soccer stadium, and used it as an internment camp and to interrogate people who they were detaining there. That sure looks a lot like what happened in Ukraine. Of course, history doesn't gift us with crisp facsimiles that are perfectly comparable in every single way. But the fact that the International Olympic Committee has said nothing about what's going on in Gaza shows that their ethical metric is quite skewed.
Thank you for that. My guest today is Jules Boykoff, and he's going to be reading from his new book, What Are the Olympics For? And that's this coming Thursday, July 18th at 7 p.m. at Palace Books. And check out also his July 8th piece with Dave Zirin. Thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure. Such a treat to speak with you, Desiree. Thank you.
This has been Desiree Helgers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.